Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about Iran, the country's politics and leadership, its role in the region, and relations between Iran and the United States. And our guest for the program is Ali Ansari. He is one of the world's leading authorities on Iran. He's professor of history at St. Andrews University, that's in Scotland, where he is also the director of the Institute for Iranian Studies. He has authored several books about Iran, including Iran Under Ahmadinejad, Iran, Islam, and Democracy, The Politics of Managing Change, and Confronting Iran, The Failure of American Foreign Policy and the Roots of Mistrust. He's visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. His visit here sponsored by the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies, as well as the Center for Global Studies. And he will be giving a talk. The title is Iran Under Ahmadinejad, and he'll be speaking this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center. And I'm sure anyone who is interested, who is in and around Champaign-Urbana, should feel welcome to attend. Here this morning as we talk, questions from callers are welcome too. All we ask of people is that they just try to keep their questions brief just so we can move along here. But anybody who is interested in calling is welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I appreciate it. I do want to talk about Iran particularly and about the Mr. Ahmadinejad and how he has done as president. But it perhaps as a way of forgiving the lens that always viewing everything through the viewpoint of the United States, I was very struck by something that you wrote in Confronting Iran, the observation that here now it's been a number of years since the Iranian Revolution. We have had a number of presidential administrations here in the United States, Democratic and Republican, and still all these many years later, it seems we really don't know what to do with Iran and really can't seem to be able to sort out the government-to-government relationship.
Well, I think there has been a real problem of mainly Western governments, but the United States in particular, of course, because Iran is a problem. It is a feature on the landscape which needs to be addressed. I think a number of administrations have tried to or made approaches tentatively to try and deal with the issue, but have really failed to grasp the nettle entirely, and that's a pity, really. I think if the United States actually had focused much earlier really on the problem that Iran posed, I think many of the issues that we face today could have been avoided. There was a tendency, I think, to just be in a state of denial and pretend it would all go away and that, you know, when we look at it again, it will be better. But in fact, actually, it gets worse. So what you really need to do is you know, after 1979, is really to focus a little bit more of your political, economic and other resources onto this issue. And you know, things are moving in the right direction, I have to say. I mean, in the last year or so, last 2 years, I think there have been moves in the right direction. I think people are beginning to think about this as a problem in its own right. I mean, I think Iran, by and large, in American, in the policy world, has either been seen as an aspect of something else, or really, it's a feature of domestic American politics. It's a way of getting votes. I mean, being rude about Iran is a very good way to get votes, but it doesn't really solve the problem.
Well, let me ask it straight out here. Do you think that Iran poses a security threat to the United States?
I don't think Iran poses a security threat to the United States itself. I think Iran poses a challenge to U.S. interests in the region. I mean, that's obviously it's almost a given if you look at the way in which obviously the United States is heavily involved in the Middle East, and it's heavily involved in the Persian Gulf and obviously in Iraq and Afghanistan, two neighbors to Iran. In many ways, as I've written elsewhere, Iran and the United States are neighbors. I mean, we can't ignore each other. And the Iranians, of course, will see the United States as a threat to its own interests. But the fact is, there's an overlap here. And I think, you know, both sides, and I would emphasize both sides, by the way, need to take these issues more seriously, because even in Iran, you know, there's an obsession with the United States in Iran, but it's not a healthy obsession.
Well, what would you say about, let's just to jump into perhaps talking about Iran and the region. So what is the significance of Iran in the Middle East?
Well, Iran has a role that is historical in the region. Certainly, it's been one of the great powers of the past, along with the what was formerly the Ottoman Empire and now, of course, Turkey. The Iranian state, and maybe it's useful for listeners if I start using the more classical term for the country, and people will begin to appreciate really that if you talk of Persia and the Persians in the region, then you begin to see that they have played a very long and profound political, cultural, economic role in the region. And I think over the last 100 and 150 years, Iranians of all political hues, by the way, this is generally a consensus view, have felt that their country has declined in power and influence. And a bit like perhaps the Chinese or the Indians, they see themselves really as wanting to assert their rightful position in the region. Now, the way they do this may not be very satisfactory to many of us, but I think it's good to understand that for many Iranians, be they living in Iran or part of the expatriate community, there's a strong desire to see the country really restored to what they consider it to be its proper place in the family of nations.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Ali Ansari. He's professor of modern history at St. Andrews University, Scotland, where he directs the Institute for Iranian Studies. He's visiting the campus. We're talking about Iran, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk about Mr. Ahmadinejad. I think that there was another occasion I was talking with someone else, and another scholar, about Iran, and said something about the fact that when he was elected, he was not well known, not widely known outside of Iran. And I think the response of the person I was talking to was, well, you know, he wasn't all that well known inside Iran. Was it to you or to other people even who follow Iranian politics when he became president, was that something of a surprise?
I think it was a major shock to the system. I think it's quite right to say that he was relatively little known in Iran itself, let alone outside the country. Nobody took him seriously. And I think that's one of his advantages in that earlier presidential election, and that people didn't really. He was an unknown factor. Mm-hmm. He seemed new. His ideas were not really scrutinized. But, of course, he had a lot of establishment support. I mean, the key is many of the very hardline elements within the system saw him as a means of achieving their ends. And they did, of course, manipulate certain aspects of the election to get him through. I mean, there's no doubt that Ahmadinejad espouses a certain form of populist politics that appealed to a certain group. He approached a sort of a very, he was the people's champion in some ways. Mm-hmm. And he approached the election from a very sort of anti-establishment position, ironic given the amount of support he had from the establishment, but also from a very sort of anti-intellectual position. I mean, he was seen as the common man and this sort of thing. And as a consequence, I think people, because they were reacting against the establishment and he was able to present himself in this way, voted for this sort of populist figure without really taking seriously some of his views. And I think they've learned to rue that moment since that time. But I'm, you know, I have to add also in that election, had he not had the help, to use that euphemism, from various establishment forces, I don't think he would have got through. I mean, it was an election that was fought in a number of rounds, two rounds, and in order to get him through the first round, there were a number of candidates who all approached a similar number of votes. He certainly, you know, pulled in a healthy fair number of votes, but it wasn't a landslide, it wasn't a clear run. And to push him through into the second round, I think it was manipulated to get him through to that. But that's not to, you know, take away from the fact that he clearly appealed to a certain section of the population.
Hmm. Well, given the fact that, and I think it's true to say that he was in large part elected on the strength of these promises that he made that he would improve the lives of people who were on the lower end of
That's right.
Economic ladder, you know, for poor and working class Iranians, he said, I'm going to make your life better. Now, 2.5, 3 years later, what can you say about how those Iranians are doing? Has he in fact done anything?
He did. He ran on what would be termed a very what could be described as a left-wing policy of basically redistributing wealth in some ways as an Islamic socialist. He didn't actually mention religion a huge amount. That was quite interesting. I mean, he realized, I think, that his religious views may be a weakness as far as the majority of Iranians were concerned, and that wasn't going to be useful to him. So he ran on a policy of basically, I mean, one of his catchphrases was that he would put oil money on the people's dinner tables. He also described himself at one stage as the Robin Hood of Iran, which was a curious way of putting it. But, you know, this was his idea of being very anti-establishment. I think what people have found since is that government by instinct is not really very workable, and that he seemed to ignore every bit of advice. And he was quite abrupt about it, actually. I mean, he was quite rude to professionals, again, anti-establishment. He'd say these economists have not done us any good. And that's what he saw as the source of the problem. And therefore, he led a government and a policy by instinct. He said, you know, I know better. Now, he was assisted by this, of course, by the fact that the oil revenues were so high that he was able to throw money into the system. And of course, he bought people's sympathies and votes to some extent. But this distribution of money into the system was done without any real sort of plan or foresight. And I think while it disguised the problems, it didn't eliminate them.
Mm. Well, and some of the things that I've read, and perhaps it's difficult to answer a question like this because it perhaps depends on your definitions and it depends on your ability to gather statistics and information and so forth. But if you ask a question, well, let's look at something like poverty, whether it has increased, decreased, or stayed the same in Iran since 2005 when he was elected, can you answer that question?
Well, I think, again, it all depends on how you define poverty. I mean, you've got to bear in mind that Iranians have very high aspirations for themselves, okay? And there's often a joke, you know, and they sort of say, well, you know, Iran is doing better than many countries in the region. And I dare say it is. But many countries in the region isn't really a great standard, I think, by which many Iranians want to assess their own country. You're not going to tell me that most Iranians are happy that they're doing better than Afghanistan or Iraq. I mean, this is not really something that I think they is a matter of pride. But certainly, I think one of the factors that's come in, and this is the way really to assess it, is that, one, the disparities in wealth have grown. I mean, the rich have grown richer. Certainly, there are rises in income among a number of people, which is, again, a matter of distributing the oil income and sort of multiplying incomes. But, of course, that doesn't match the rate of inflation. And I think what you have to judge is really the level of aspiration and hope against the reality that they've achieved. So in some ways, in absolute terms, you can say that, you know, an individual salary check may have gone up. But in relative terms, and this is the crucial thing, relative to the goals that he claimed he could achieve, he's fallen well short. Mm.
There will be a presidential election next year, and he would be eligible to run again, so he can run again. Do you think that he will run again?
I think most definitely. And I think the establishment or the governing elite in many ways will do everything they possibly can to make sure he's elected. And I put that in inverted commas because I don't see this as going to be any type of fair contest. You know, Iran has had probably more elections than any other country in the Middle East, barring Israel. It has them very, very regularly. I don't think you call them democratic by the standards of the West, but I think up until about 2000, they were being, or 2001, they were certainly, the trend was in the right direction, I think you could say. There was a growing liberalization of the political process. But since that time, this process of liberalization has receded. And what they've done is they've sought to manipulate and sort of contract that electoral process. So what you're getting is actually a series of candidates that have been nominated and the public have to come and acclaim them. And that's not really the sort of thing that most people in Iran aspire to. The downside of that, of course, is that turnout becomes very, very low. I think some people will go and vote whatever. But there is a problem for the Islamic Republic in the sense that it loses an element of political legitimacy because, you know, you can't have it both ways.
Mm. So just to wrap up for this point, and then we're going to get some callers.
Sure.
You would say that as for all his being a source of controversy, you would say that he continues to have enough of the support of the people in the country that matter so that it would be fairly clear that he not only would he run again, but he would be likely to be elected.
I think if there was anything approaching a free election in Iran, Ahmadinejad would lose. Yeah. I mean, that is quite clear. I don't think he can win without having it very, very heavily manipulated in his favor. The trouble is that you have a clique in Iran now who don't see that as a problem.
Our guest again this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Ali Ansari. He's an historian, professor of modern history at St. Andrews University in Scotland. He is the director of the Institute for Iranian Studies and has been following Iranian politics for a long time. He's here visiting the campus to talk about Iran under Ahmadinejad, and we'll be talking later today. And later on, I'll give you the information on that again. Right now, though, we have a number of callers, and we'll start in with someone in Champaign County, and this is line one. Hello.
Hi. You sort of invited this question. I hope I can get to your talk and ask you a question more on what you're going to be speaking on. But on the On this, you sort of suggest that after 79 there was implied there was some missed opportunity to handle things differently. I think it would be important for Americans to realize, you know, what did happen, that the U.S. helped instigate the Iran-Iraq War. Kissinger said, let them kill each other off, armed both sides in a variety of ways and that kind of thing. And another aspect that is not well commented on, but I think Robert Dreyfuss in Devil's Game points out that the U.S. has preferred the mullahs to any kind of nationalist, leftist, or progressive elements. And there are persistent rumors that there were deals cut in a variety of ways and of course during Iran-Contra it did bolster the mullahs at that time. So there's an explicit thing. Of course, there were other purposes, but that might have been part of the neat deal that as it was called at the time. So I would see that as the background, and maybe you have a lot of people don't realize that. Americans confuse Iran and Iraq a fair amount of the time, I'm afraid, and don't know the complexities. I was astonished to see that Ossetians actually speak Farsi, even though they're Orthodox. So the Persian Empire has a legacy back that far. So I have to hang up, and I'll let you on. Deal to it. Thank you.
All right. Mm-hmm.
No. I mean, I think there have been opportunities missed on both sides. And I mean, my argument has really been on the American side when you're looking at it, that it has much more to do with an incoherence of policy or an absence of it than really a deliberate act. I think a succession of U.S. presidents have really found Iran too hot to handle. They think it has too many political costs at home. It's not worth it. And yet a succession of them have, in some ways, tried to make some outreach, but have really pulled back before anything interesting can happen. There's always, of course, a case of missed timings. I mean, on both sides, you know, one side will make a sort of a tentative approach, but the domestic political environment isn't suitable for that to be exploited. I think, to my mind, the greatest opportunity that was really missed, and this is really a Western problem rather than an American one, was really the presidency of Mohammad Khatami, which started in 1997. I think there was a period then when we had this discussion of dialogue of civilizations. There was a genuine approach, I think, to the United States at the time. And to be honest, the United States fumbled. I mean, it didn't quite know how to react to this cleric. But then subsequently, I think and the Iranians themselves missed a number of opportunities. Perhaps the most serious one for the Bush administration was really when the Axis of Evil speech was made in January 2002, because this came after, very sadly, a period when the Iranians had actually assisted the coalition and the UN in the prosecuting the war against the Taliban in Afghanistan. And I think the Iranians had felt with some justification that they might get something positive out of this cooperation, but found that no, they were put in together with Iraq and North Korea. And I should say, I mean, it tells us something about the Iranians that it wasn't so much the fact that they were labelled an axis of evil, it was the fact that they were put in with Iraq and North Korea that really offended them. I mean, they thought this was really a bit cheap. So, you know, I think these are opportunities that were lost, and certainly under the current Bush administration, you know, I would say that there's been a sense of, I think, hubris would be fair to describe it as that. I mean, they didn't really want to do it. They felt they could deal with Iran after they dealt with Iraq, so on and so forth. But, you know, the situation was really not dealt with until, I would say, other elements in the government really in the last 18 months have begun to try and reconstruct a sort of a base of expertise within the American administration. And I think that's now beginning to yield some results.
Mm-hmm. Although now we're going to have an election, we're going to have another administration, and that seems that that may well toss that. Is that going to toss that all up in the air, or could there be some carryover?
Well, I think one of the positive things of this crisis, this continuing crisis, is that for the first time, yes, I mean, Iran is a central feature of the sort of the political debate in the United States. I mean, my hope is that this debate actually moves away from polemics and starts to look at the situation in a much more serious and sober manner, and that both, you know, candidates really deal with this as an issue. I think the previous caller, you know, made a very interesting point about the Ossetians in Georgia. It's quite true, you know, that Iran, you know, these territories in the Caucasus were actually taken from Iran in the 19th century by the Russians. I mean, these are old imperial territories for the Iranians. And there is a lot of influence in the region, and a lot of influence that they could use very constructively if that opportunity in some way were afforded to them. But I think also we have to be serious about the problems that the Ahmadinejad administration represents.
We'll talk next with someone in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Good morning. Fascinating. I'd like to go back to something that you spoke about earlier when you were asked if Iran poses threats to the United States, and you said no, but it poses a threat to our interests, and our interests presumably are oil. And I wonder if you would talk about that. And also, hopefully, we will elect a Democratic president and we will begin to withdraw the troops from Iraq, where we shouldn't have gone in the first place. And I wonder what role you will see, what role you think Iran will be playing in the area after that.
I mean, I actually don't see Iran as a threat to America's oil interests, in for one particular reason, that Iran wants to sell its oil and would be quite happy to sell it to the United States. In fact, until President Clinton brought in the executive order in 1996, if I'm not mistaken, a lot of Iran's oil was being shipped to the United States, or you know, through third parties, basically. I mean, I should clarify that it was being bought by American oil companies. I mean, they were selling it elsewhere, perhaps. But I mean, certainly, you know, the American oil companies were big purchasers, and the Iranians are more than happy to sell oil. I think the real clash comes in the fact that you have basically Iran sees itself as having regional interests. And these regional interests are obviously, you know, they confront the United States there. Now, the irony of it is, of course, is that actually the United States and Iran have a huge range of coincidence of interest in the region. Neither party likes the Taliban. Neither party likes, you know, the radical Sunni movements. Neither party really has an interest in seeing Iraq fragment. The question really is who should hold the influence in that country. And the Iranians say that, you know, this is our you know, home territory, really, frankly. You know, if we started setting up base in Mexico, I think you'd get a little bit irritated, you know. So it's really a case of, you know, us having a sort of a regional influence. And I think one of the challenges for American policymakers is how do you accommodate and delineate that? How do you allow for a level of influence while also, you know, letting the Iranians know that you can't have it all your own way? It's simply not going to happen. But, you know, I think there should be a way of being able to accommodate both interests.
And on the question of Iran building a nuclear weapon, what is your reaction to the state of that and how much we should be concerned about it?
Well, I think there's a very serious proliferation issue. I mean, I think that there's no doubt about that. I think the Iranians are quite keen to develop the options, which is something, obviously, that the United States and particularly Israel are not keen for them to do. And, of course, the Europeans are along with that. But I think in terms of a genuine sort of nuclear existential threat, I think we're very much a long way off from this. Even the Iranians themselves will privately concede that, you know, what they're looking for are to develop, basically to provide themselves with the options. They consider they live in a very dangerous neighbourhood. They're more concerned, to be honest, about Pakistan than they are about Israel. But nonetheless, they like the idea that they should have the technological sophistication to provide them with the option. But they don't see themselves really as ever being able to compete in terms of a nuclear arsenal with either the United States or Israel or any other nuclear power for that matter. I mean, they don't have the capacity to build anything on that such a scale. But of course, achieving that technology provides them with a certain amount of prestige and political clout. So I think that's where the issue is. And I think there are quite serious areas of concern there. There's no doubt about it.
Thank you.
All right. So this certainly has been a point of contention between the U.S. and Iran. Mm-hmm. And the United States has argued that Iran is interested in building nuclear weapons. And consistently the official position of the government of Iran has been to say no, that is not our interest. What we're interested in is developing nuclear power, civilian nuclear power infrastructure so that we can have an energy source. Because it is true that they do have significant oil, that maybe doesn't meet all of their energy needs. And so they say, well, we're interested in nuclear power for electricity generation. And so it sounds as if from your responses that, well, the answer is, well, yes and no. I mean, yes, indeed, they may be interested in it as an energy source. And maybe while they're not interested in developing nuclear weapons immediately, that you can't say that that's completely, for the Iranians, that that's completely off the table.
No, I think that's, I mean, but basically what you have in Iran, I mean, the problem is that they have very sound reasons for diversifying their energy sources, just as any other country has, to be honest. And they say that, look, we have a growing population, we need to provide electricity, we'd like to retain oil and gas for export, it brings us a certain amount of revenue. The problem they have is that they, even their economic plans for nuclear energy and power are not really very coherent. I mean, if they were to develop their nuclear plans as they state, I don't think it would actually achieve all their energy needs anyway. They'd need to develop other sorts of energy. Plus the fact that they haven't, you know, for the developments they're doing at the moment, there don't seem to be any power plants really for these enriched uranium to fuel. I mean, there are sufficient doubts and suspicions to cause concern. But I, you know, I've always been on the view that that this whole nuclear crisis, be it from an American point of view or an Iranian point of view, is a matter of sort of politics and principle rather than anything else. I don't think it makes a huge amount of sense on either side when you look at the facts on the ground. I don't think the Iranians have really thought through what the economic projections are for the introduction of nuclear power. I think they just want to feel that, you know, they can do this in spite of all the pressures against them. On the other side, to be perfectly honest, if the United States and Iran were friends, I don't think Iran's transgressions would have caused anyone to bat an eyelid on this side. I mean, they're not so great as, you know, many other countries have, you know, got the capability and have this position, but they're not obviously on very bad terms. So I've always said that the nuclear issue is a symptom of a wider malaise in Iran-US relations. It's not a cause. I mean, there are many other issues. And if you look back 18 months ago, far more important than the nuclear issue was Iran's role in Iraq. That hit the headlines far more frequently. And of course, this caused a huge number of problems with America's European allies because they kept saying, well, we thought your issues were a proliferation issue, but it now seems that you're more preoccupied with Iraq. And, you know, the Russians in particular said, well, we're not really going to play ball on this anymore. So, you know, you can see that really, as far as Iran-US is concerned, when one issue diminishes, another issue is raised. When the other issue is diminishes, you know, we come back to nuclear. You know, these are all issues. These are all problems. I don't want to diminish them. But the fact is that I think the core of the issue is the fundamental malaise and distrust which exists between the political elites, I should add, of the United States and Iran.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Ali Ansari. He's professor of modern history at St. Andrews University in Scotland. He's also director of the Institute for Iranian Studies, and Iran and its modern history is something of particular interest of his. He'll be giving a talk on the topic Iran under Ahmadinejad, and that'll be this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the U of I campus at the Levis Center. Anyone interested should feel welcome to stop by. His visit here to the campus is sponsored by the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies and the Center for Global Studies. And questions here are welcome. We have some callers, and we'll get right back to it. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Next, we'll speak with someone in Bloomington, Indiana, and this would be our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi. About not diminishing the threat that the Iranians pose under Ahmadinejad, you can just start out. They're oil rich, with oil at over $100 a barrel, and they can not only oil rich, they can threaten the world by threatening to withhold oil. They are also clearly seeking nuclear weapons. I mean, good grief, who doubts that they're seeking nuclear weapons? And they have, well, at least Ahmadinejad would represent them as having a culture of martyrdom. They don't care if they die, they want to die. That means that massive retaliation is not a deterrent. I mean, you deter an aggressor by saying, if you attack us, we're going to kill more, we're going to retaliate and kill more of you than you have killed of us. That doesn't work with them. They're supposed to want to die. And also, their theology, the Muslim theology, says they need to create chaos in order to gain the arrival of their Messiah, this Mahdi. They have threatened, Ahmadinejad has threatened to wipe Israel off the map. But Israel is the little Satan. America is the great Satan. Now, you talk about a loose cannon. I think the most dangerous thing we can, the most dangerous thing we can do is not to take these people seriously.
I think that I think you're quite right to say that Iran is a problem that needs to be taken seriously. But I also don't think I think the best way is to look at it soberly, not to exaggerate a number of the issues. Ahmadinejad is a deeply unpleasant character with I have described elsewhere as a number of views that approach millenarianism. But, some of the descriptions you've described could be applied to millenarianists the world over. And, the doctrine of creative destruction is something that the neoconservatives in this country really pursued. So it's a lot of these notions, could be applied elsewhere. And there are people with very, how should we say, awkward religious views in a number of different countries. I honestly do believe, and this is my view, and I've said it over and over again, that I think, Ahmadinejad does pose an existential threat, but that threat is to Iran itself. I don't think it's to any other country. I think he's done an enormous amount of damage. And, to argue, for instance, that Iran could withhold its oil or whatever, this is a country that depends on its oil revenue. It's not going to do that. It's a network of basically patronage that requires revenue. And this sort of what we would call this martyrdom complex, yes, there are people in Iran who hold that view. I would say they're in a striking minority. You could draw, of course, parallels between those who have views about the end of times, say, in the United States as well as in Iran. I mean, it all depends on what sort of influence they have on the political process. I'm not saying, of course, that, Ahmadinejad, as I said, is it should not be taken seriously. I think, as I mentioned earlier, one of the major problems we had is that even in Iran, they didn't take him seriously enough until it was a bit late, until he'd got into office. But I think also the United States should not approach this issue from a background of sort of fear or hysteria. I think if you deal with it in a very sober manner, you'll see that, as I've said to many others, Iran does not stand 7 foot tall. It's not a giant. And frankly, if the United States pays a bit more attention and puts half the resources again as it's doing now, I think it's eminently solvable.
Thank you for your answer.
Thank you.
All right, and let's go to next, line number 3, and this is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I wish you would address a question, particularly in view of the statement of the last caller. Would you explain the position of Ahmadinejad? He's the president, and that title suggests something to many Americans, perhaps most. The president being the head of state, the commander-in-chief of the army, and the equal or perhaps the more equal of three branches of government, to paraphrase Orwell. I think this is a matter that confuses Americans.
Yes, no, I mean, in actual fact, I mean, Ahmadinejad is not commander-in-chief of the armed forces in Iran, because that task is allocated to the supreme leader, and you're quite right to point out, and I think it is important to explain that in Iran you have a sort of a divided structure between the supreme leader, who runs basically it used to be called a shadow government, but it's fairly explicit now. I mean, everyone knows it's there, and it's quite extensive. And the supreme leader has the last word. Now, the real problem with Iran is not so much that you have people in control of anything. It's really that you have a sort of an agglomeration of different factions sitting at the high table, each negotiating particular positions. So Ahmadinejad could be fairly influential on one level, but could be constrained in others. The supreme leader is, I suppose, the primus inter pares, the first among equals. But even he has to maneuver between different factions and different views. And that makes government in Iran actually a fairly cumbersome machine. I mean, I've argued at times that the chief characteristic of Iranian government is inertia. It doesn't really do a huge amount. It talks a lot. It makes a number of obnoxious comments. But it seems at times, really, in terms of its activities, that it's not very decisive in a number of things that it does. Now, of course, that's a simplification. I don't want to exaggerate that myself. But certainly one of the problems that Iranians have found, and this is why they became increasingly disillusioned with the whole government process, is that they find that their government actually is really a playground for the elites to argue out their own positions, but it doesn't actually do a huge amount that one could consider to be decisively in their favor.
That was actually, I suppose, what was disastrous for Khatami.
Yes, I mean, I think that's absolutely true. And the fact is that Khatami tried to put certain things through. But, of course, you know, these vested interests got in the way. And at the end of the day, he didn't have that sort of political will or that energy to push things through.
May I say something about the gentleman from Indiana, the assertion that the Iranians are bent on martyrdom?
Mm.
I think that may be true of some, but is hardly true of the population.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, Iranians, you know, ironically enough, are some of the most materialist people I've ever met, and they're frankly not very interested in sort of these rather altruistic conceptions. There is a great dichotomy in Iranian society, of course. There is a division, but you know, you get peculiar views everywhere, I'm afraid, and I think you'll find that in Iran, they exist, but they're a minority.
They do have a great love for their nation and a great pride in it.
That's right.
Which would make them defend the nation fiercely.
I think that's the, yes, that's a completely, that's a distinct thing rather than, but as I said, I don't think they're interested in destroying their nation.
No. Well, thank you so much. And I look forward to your talk this afternoon.
And we'll continue. We'll talk next with a caller in Urbana, someone else in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask your guests about the Iran-Iraq War, and this, essentially it's the same government since the late 70s, early 80s, and into that time when Hussein, you know, the Iraqis invaded Iran. And I remember distinctly the Iranians had running into some military problems, and they would basically, like, draft children, let's say 15, 16, 17-year-old boys, and send them in, you know, in waves at the Iraqi army and were slaughtered. And what is that? Because the British press covered that extensively, and they had follow-ups years later about the martyr graves where they had these children that were basically, you know, slaughtered for no reason other than the fact they just wanted to send waves of bodies. Kind of reminded, I was in Southeast Asia 40 years ago, and somewhat that was happening if you confronted the Vietnamese with that. They would send just basically kids at you. But I'm wondering what the current Iranian ideas are about that. Are the parents of these people, who are obviously much older now, if not dead, is there a sort of a social remembrance of that as a positive, or is it a negative? Because, you know, if we took 15-year-old kids now and sent them to Iraq and had them slaughtered, it's like in the invasion, I wonder what the American people would think of that. Could you comment on that?
Well, I mean, I think the issue of human wave attacks and these issues have been discussed, I mean, by military historians and others. I mean, it's a question of when you have a surplus of, in very crude terms, of manpower over technology. I mean, you saw this in the Russians in the Second World War as well. They tend to be much more reckless in their expenditure of human lives. There's no doubt about it. I think the issue of sort of drafting youths into the army or basically forcing them in, there's a lot of debate about that, actually. I mean, I haven't seen actually significant evidence of saying that they actually dragooned people, children in. There is a difference there, of course, in the sense that we have to bear in mind that under sort of Orthodox Islamic law, the age of manhood is achieved at 14. So, of course, you know, that is an issue. There's no doubt about it. Now, on the more important point, which I think you raise, which I think is very important, about the consequences of the war, I think one of the things people, and certainly in the West, don't really appreciate is, yes, it had a very traumatizing effect on the Iranian population. I mean, Iranians aren't in a rush to go to war again. I think it had a very, very bad... There are huge memorials, I mean, everywhere. The impact of the Iran-Iraq War is very similar to the impact of, say, the First World War, the Great War on the British and French public, where whole generations, you know, I mean, families lost huge numbers of people. And, of course, it's not simply the dead, it's also the casualties and the disabled. So you'll find, and I think this is very much reflected in the cinema that came out of Iran also after the Iran-Iraq War, there's a very, very anti-war mood in Iran. They don't see it as something to be glorified in that sense. And even the few attempts by filmmakers to make you know, what we would call sort of very sort of gung-ho and chauvinistic films, did not go down well with the population at all. I think one area where it's had quite a significant impact on politics in Iran and has been exploited by politicians is the role of veterans and how veterans are treated. Again, you know, I know that's a significant issue here as well, but that's clearly had a had an impact on the way in which, say, particularly someone like Ahmadinejad or Khatami before him were able to sort of exploit that veterans' vote. And each side has always wanted to claim to be, you know, more in line with the veterans' wishes. But again, it's very important to bear in mind that the effect of the Iran-Iraq War was really to put people off the idea altogether.
Oh, good. Could I want one other thing before I hang up? Sure. I want to know, since you obviously go there and you know people there, I know the UN has sanctions against Iran, and I've noticed there have been in the press. The European press, especially the Americans, don't really cover it very quickly. You know, a couple of civilian airliner crashes, and there was insinuations that were blamed on parts shortages.
Sure.
So because they're, you know, they can be theoretically used for military purposes, you know, so they're cross purposes. Could you discuss how that has really affected their, you talked earlier about the economic problems in that country. I'm wondering how good the sanctions are and how much that has affected their psychology. And thank you. I'll come to your...
Thank you. Goodbye. No, I mean, I think it's definitely... I think the sanctions have had an effect, but I think they've had an effect, or their effect has been multiplied by the singular fact that Ahmadinejad has made such a pig's ear of the economy. I mean, he's basically exposed the country to the effect of sanctions in a way that perhaps previous administrations would not have. And certainly the issue of dual-use technology that you raise is one that needs to be addressed, because I think some of the descriptions of dual-use technology are so extensive that, you know, frankly, you can't sell anything. The issue of plane parts is a real sticking point in Iran. And, of course, it's one that the government exploits to show that, you know, this is the perfidious nature of the West, that, you know, and the Americans in particular, that we're not allowed to get spare parts for our civilian airliners. But, you know, it's an issue that hopefully, you know, a new administration will look at in a little bit more detail, because it's one area where, in terms of public relations, that I think the United States could do better.
Another caller here, also someone in Urbana, line two. Hello?
Hello?
Yes?
Yeah, you might have discussed this already, but what would you think that Russia would do, if anything, if it was decided to go after the nuclear infrastructure in Iran?
I think the Russians would definitely be opposed to that. But, you know, the Russian relationship with Iran is quite ambiguous. I mean, they're very keen to irritate the West, and the Americans in particular, by opposing any further sanctions and increasing their business relations with Iran. But it's also quite curious to see that even the nuclear power plant that they've been helping to complete in Bushehr just never seems to get completed. I mean, they keep delaying its completion. And I think the Iranians are probably quite right to say, what are the Russians doing here? I mean, they keep taking our money, but they don't keep delivering. And I think that in some ways sums up the relationship. I mean, it's basically, I don't think the Russians have any particular affection for the Iranians, but they do see the Iran and the Iranian problem as a way of maybe using a bit of leverage of the West and maybe showing the Americans that, look, we can be useful. I don't know quite how things will pan out after the events in Georgia, but certainly I think we can fairly be fairly certain that the Russians aren't going to be in a rush to support any further UN sanctions.
Well, this I think the question takes us back to some of the comments that the President Ahmadinejad has made about Israel, and the concern that if anybody was going to feel threatened, it would be the Israelis, and if anybody was going to take action against Iran's nuclear infrastructure, it would be Israel. In looking at some of the things that Mr. Ahmadinejad has said, some people have said, well, yes, if you were Israel, certainly you would be concerned about this. You have to give that some level of concern. But at the same time, people have said, well, you know, really what this was all – these remarks were made for internal consumption. He was talking to the people of Iran, and that you have to be careful about distinguishing between the domestic political uses of that kind of posture and what is real policy and what Iran might really do. I mean, how is one to understand those things that he said about Israel?
Well, I mean, I think there's been a lot of ink spilt over trying to interpret what he said. I mean, the trouble with Mr. Ahmadinejad is what you see is what you get. So, I mean, what he does is he sort of speaks his mind. And I think in some cases he believes in these things. What he, you know, in terms of wiping Israel off the map, he there's definitely a case to be made that, you know, he was basically speaking the passive voice. And, you know, he was saying that in time we will see, as he's sought to explain since then, you know, as the Soviet Union collapsed, so, you know, the Israeli state will collapse. But the point is, you know, it's also fair to say that he's no friend of the state of Israel. I mean, he would quite happily encourage its demise. I don't think he's ever called for genocide. And, you know, I think people have sort of tended to exaggerate some of his comments. I think his comments are bad enough. I don't know why people want to sort of like extend them even further. I think his comments on the Holocaust are even worse, actually, to be perfectly honest. But it probably comes to his rather perverse notion that somehow the state of Israel was founded on a myth, which he says, and this myth was the Holocaust. And therefore, if you undermine this myth, you undermine the legitimacy of the state of Israel. I mean, this is all what we would call vulgar intellectualism or whatever, and it's all just sheer nonsense. It's not actually geared, interestingly enough, towards an Iranian audience. It's actually geared towards the Arab street. It's geared towards the wider Muslim community, where he considers himself to be very popular. It's very interesting to see the reaction of Iranians to these comments, and they weren't actually as supportive as people think. Iranians were a bit bewildered by what he was saying. They didn't understand. They couldn't care less, some of them. But there was also a view that actually he'd overstepped the line, and the reaction to the Holocaust conference in particular among older Iranians was very, very poor. I mean, they thought that he'd really gone overboard. And he has tried to pull back, but there's no doubt about it that, you know, his views on Israel are deeply disturbing. I think the way the Israelis and others need to view it is, yes, within a certain context. To see, you know, really that this is the rhetoric of ignorance. But at the same time, one doesn't want to go so far and to say that this is a, you know, he tried to say something else, because I don't think he did. I think he was very clear about what he wanted to say.
We have a couple of minutes left. I hope you'll forgive a question where we really don't have enough time to get into it in as much depth. But I think that Americans often have a difficult time understanding Iranian politics, because they hear they hear these terms, reformers and conservatives. Mm. And I guess we try to put what we might understand to mean on there. And that, I think, has led people to believe that somehow within Iran, there's a much more liberal kind of political group or individuals, and that somehow if we could just get to those people and build bridges with them, that there might be some possibility that those people could come into government, and then that would completely change the relationship between the two countries. And I think that may well be a great misunderstanding of what, within the Iranian context, it would mean to be a reformer or the opposition to the clerics that are in power. Now, I mean, what really does that mean? And if the United States could do something to bolster those people, would that indeed, and if they could, it's a lot of ifs, and if they could come to power, well, then would that mean something dramatic in terms of relations between the two countries?
I think the fundamental misunderstanding from an American perspective is to actually see in reformers the term revolutionaries. Reformers want to reform the system as it is. They don't want to overthrow it, by and large. I think you'll find that in Iran, there is a whole range of political views. It's extremely dynamic in a number of ways. The architecture of democracy is there. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's a question of really igniting it and getting it to work. And I think you'll find that, you know, many of the bases for a very constructive relationship in the future are there. Our sadness is really that a clique have basically dominated it. I mean, that's our problem. But, you know, one of the things, and I say this in the book, I say one of the things that I think Americans and Iranians need to remember, and I think it's a very fundamental one, that this great sense of betrayal that either side sees towards each other could not have occurred, could not have been delivered if there hadn't been a very intimate friendship beforehand. And this is something that I think we have to remember, that the relationship between the United States and Iran prior to 1979 was amongst the most intimate of any two countries in the world, and that you cannot understand the level of sense of betrayal that particularly the Americans feel, and of course the Iranians to some extent feel, if you don't realize that, you know, that it was based on a friendship. And I think many people hope that, you know, sooner or later that friendship will be tentatively, but, you know, will will be gradually rekindled.
And how, though, how do people in Iran think about the fact that in 1953, the United States was involved in a coup that overthrew the government and put into place the Shah, which was, you know, his oversight of Iran, not necessarily known for respect of human rights. And then that was what the revolution came along to sweep aside.
Well, there are a lot of mythologies in the histories of both countries. I mean, the Americans have 1979, the Iranians have 1953. And these are things, yes, absolutely, that need to be addressed and dealt with. I think you could, if you wanted, go back, as I do in my book, a bit further and see actually that the American approach to Iran had also very, very many constructive elements to it. So these are factors that need to be addressed in a very, very constructive and, you know, critical way on both sides. But certainly these myths need to be these events, and I use myth not in they obviously occurred, but in terms of how they've really become institutionalized within popular memory. I think these need to be tackled in a constructive way.
Yeah. And in here, though, in the foreseeable future, do you see much change, potential for change in the relationship?
You know, one of the things that gives me some hope, believe it or not, is that what you're seeing, and you know, when someone says to me that 18 months ago there was one person on the Iran desk in the State Department, which I think that's probably slightly exaggerated, but they say one person, and now you have about 12 people in the State Department working on Iran. I always like to think that, you know, the more you build your expertise, the more people pay attention, it's got to be a good thing.
Yeah. Our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Ali Ansari. He's professor of history at St. Andrews University in Scotland, where he's also director of the Institute for Iranian Studies. He is visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We'll be giving a talk, Iran Under Ahmadinejad. That's this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus, co-sponsored by the Center for Global Studies and the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. And so if you're interested, you can stop by. And his most recent book would be Iran Under Ahmadinejad. That book is actually out now.
It's a booklet, I think I would call it. It's not too long.
All right. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.